Assalamu alaikum, peace be with you, and good evening. You're listening to Radio Islam at WCV 1450 AM in Chicago, Illinois. This is Malik Mujahid. I'm your host, and Radio Islam is a live call-in talk radio program airing every day 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Central Time, and we reach the world by streaming live at www.radioislam.com, where you can tap into all our prior shows as well. To add to the conversation, you can call at 312-263-ISLAM. That is 312-263-ISLAM. And you can always post on facebook.com/Radio Islam USA or at Radio Islam USA on Twitter. Today we'll try to understand what is the military industrial complex, and to discuss that with us is William Hartung, who's author of an author and director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, and he's author of the book Prophets of War: Lockheed Martin and the Making of Military Industrial Complex. Welcome to Radio Islam, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So how long have you been doing that? I mean, you have been director of Arms and Security Project Center for International Policy, and you have served as Senior Research Fellow in the New America Foundation's American Strategy Program, and former director of Arms Trade Resource Center of World Policy Institute. So how long have you been into weapons and economy of military spending and all that?
Well, I started working on these issues when I first got out of college at a think tank called the Council on Economic Priorities in New York. So I would say,
Didn't come out of college yesterday, did you?
I did not. I wish I had. I would say 30-plus years I've been working on these issues.
Wow. So there were people at that time who were still crazy. Well, that will be a compliment, because nowadays, nobody gets into these type of fields. Still a period of idealism, and people are still probably campaigning against apartheid and whatnot.
Oh, exactly. Yes, actually, that was sort of how I got involved in this issue. I was, as a student, I worked on the divestment campaign.
Oh, you did?
And my specialty was tracking violations of the arms embargo.
On South Africa?
And that sort of followed into the work I'm doing now.
Okay, well, I would like to know more about those days I hear about and read about. But tell us, let's define, what is this military-industrial complex?
Well, the term was coined in a speech by Dwight Eisenhower in 1961. And what he had in mind was a sort of collusion between the uniformed military and the Pentagon and the weapons contractors, which was partly to get more taxpayer money by promoting weapons that we may or may not need for defense. But he saw it as a bigger problem. He saw it as pushed to the limit as a threat to democracy, because it could distort foreign policy, and it could also kind of have a cultural effect in terms of militarization of thinking, kind of putting forward military solutions as almost the primary way to address serious problems in the world. So he had a quite...
Wow, I like that term, militarization of thinking.
So he had a quite deep concern about this. It was more than just about the money, although money was one of the issues. But it was really about... could you sustain this big military complex and still sustain your vigorous democracy? And his concern was partly because before World War II, the United States had always demobilized to a large degree between wars. But after World War II, you got this permanent arms establishment, which never really went back in the box. I mean, it has remained at a very high level ever since. And that permanent arms establishment was what concerned Eisenhower.
Well, before we go in more detail of it, I always heard of that he said that in his farewell address. So farewell address took place January 17th, 1961. I wonder what will be in President Obama's farewell address, if there is one coming. Is that tradition still alive, a farewell address to the nation?
I haven't seen that in recent years. I think Eisenhower really wanted to do that because of this issue, wanting to put this issue on the table.
You think the primary focus of his speech was this issue?
Yes. There was another related topic, which was the scientific industrial elite, was scientific research getting ahead of us in terms of, shaping our policies, and also were people conducting science sort of primarily to get government grants, or was it really to discover new things? And so he was concerned that science also was becoming kind of bureaucratized and not necessarily carried out in a way that would be most effective in terms of actually increasing our store of knowledge.
Okay. So if our listeners, if some of you must be wiser than me, but I heard references to President Eisenhower saying that, but I didn't hear his words. So here are his words. He was President of the United States, but also a five-star general during World War II. And he used this term in his farewell address to the nation on January 17th, 1961. He said, a vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. And he said, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the accusations of unwarranted influence, whether soft or unsoft, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disaster arise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Do you think he was very prophetic in what he was saying?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think the military-industrial complex is just as relevant today as it was when he gave his speech.
Just relevant today, or it is stronger and more preeminent?
Well, the Pentagon budget is about twice what it was when Eisenhower gave his speech.
And that is taken into consideration, all the inflation and everything?
Yes. Yes, and so it's considerably larger, and the companies are much larger than they were, because there was a huge merger boom in the 90s. So Lockheed Martin, for example, is a combination of 20 different companies that merged or were acquired, and the final step was the merger of Lockheed with Martin Marietta. Northrop Grumman is a combination of Northrop and Grumman and a bunch of other companies. Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas, which used to be a major defense contractor. So you've got these huge industrial combinations that are much larger than anything Eisenhower had to confront.
But, you know, one of the things which, you know, he's saying the total influence, economic, political, even spiritual. What do you think he meant by spiritual? And he says it is felt city and state house and every office of federal government.
I've thought about that. You know, I haven't seen anywhere where he elaborated on that question of the spiritual effects of the military-industrial complex. I kind of interpret it as a moral statement. You know, the great religions all aim towards peace and aim towards fairness. And I think he felt that, you know, this kind of, if you let the military establishment run away and set your priorities, peace and fairness would be undermined.
I thought he had some early insight into the phenomena of Christian right.
I really would like to know more about his thinking process during that time.
Did he continue to dwell on this topic in his life before he passed away, or this was something he gave in the speech and then he didn't address this? Did he continue to speak on this issue?
Not particularly. I mean, occasionally he would make reference to it, and you see references in his papers, but most of the references are from when he was still president. You know, early in his term, he gave a speech that's been referred to as the Cross of Iron speech, which talks about how essentially every ship built, every tank constructed is a theft from people who are hungry and don't have enough to eat, from people who need housing and so forth. So he kind of highlighted the trade-offs between a big military and meeting the needs of the people of the country. So it was quite interesting, given that he was a general who led forces in World War II, a Republican. You know, the kind of things that he said would certainly not be said by a Republican today.
But so he talked about economics and political, even spiritual, but probably if he was alive today, he will include that sports in there, sports and entertainment, and probably many other aspects of it.
Well, I think, you know, things like war games that are played on computers, it's a huge industry, and it's basically just strapping yourself into your computer and simulating the act of killing people.
My goodness, I entered my son's, I hope he's not listening, room, and he has, in this computer game, there was some knife going around. And so what is this? So he was controlling the knife, and it was going around killing. So it probably defines majority of the video games, don't you think?
Yes, and there's a somewhat of a similarity between the dexterity and the hand-eye coordination to do some of these video games and the new type of warfare. You know, for example, we have a drone operator sitting at a computer controlling a drone halfway around the world. It's not precisely the same, but there's common elements to that, even to the point where, you know, a drone pilot doesn't need to be physically fit in the same way as a soldier who's in the field and so forth. So I think, you know, that there's debates about what, you know, the effect of those games on people in terms of their, you know, how they view the world. But I think it can't be good, the prevalence of those games. And it's just, you know,
are you saying there is not much of a research on what are the impact of those video games, or research is non-conclusive?
There's conflicting reports about the impact. You know, my gut feeling is that I don't see how it could be positive to have that kind of focus, especially for kids who do it nonstop, which some kids do, you know.
Yeah, and also on the demonization of the other. I haven't watched many of those games, but how did they define the enemy? How enemy looks like?
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of that, but I think there is a racist element in some of the games also.
Okay, so let's go back to, leave the Eisenhower on one side, but why do we leave him? Are there other, statesmen who have spoken on this topic, or this became the topic in which people of peace movement are only interested in?
Well, in terms of United States presidents, President Kennedy focused on the nuclear threat at the end of his life, not as much on just the vast size of the military-industrial complex. So it's rare that you'll have a prominent elected leader who will use that language or point out that problem. The one person that I can recall in recent times using the term was actually Senator John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, because he was trying to stop the F-22 fighter plane, which was the most expensive fighter plane ever built. And the Pentagon decided they had enough, but the Air Force and Lockheed Martin were lobbying for more. And on the Senate floor, McCain said, well, this is the military-industrial complex at work. They're trying to force us to buy weapons we don't need for the profit of particular companies. So it'll come up on occasion, but it's probably more referred to in the peace movement by critics of the military establishment. And certainly in the 60s, after, shortly after Eisenhower gave the speech, it was very much picked up by the anti-war movement.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. This is your host Malik Mujahid, and I'm talking with William Hartung about the military-industrial complex. And as we come back, we'll look into its complexity.
Radio Islam. It's time to reach the world. Advertising on Radio Islam every day is like speaking to a packed house at Soldier Field Stadium. Imagine your reach. With our affordable rates, you will be wondering why you hadn't signed on before. But that's okay. Better now than never. Send your email to advertising@radioislam.com.
Welcome back to Radio Islam. This is your host Malik Mujahid, and you're listening to WCAV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. And we're talking with William Hartung, who was a peace activist and keeps an eye on military-industrial complex. William, tell me this. What do you expect from the new administration? Because here is a president-elect who criticizes CIA and FBI, and all the military people don't know what they were doing, and look at what they discovered. And so do you think you have an skeptic of military-industrial complex, or is he some way an integral part of it?
Well, he's given mixed signals.
That defines him. Yes, about on every topic.
That is
it?
The essence of Donald Trump, yes. On the campaign trail, he said things like, we're buying missiles we don't need because, just because of the contractors' special interest lobbying, and his crowds would actually clap at that. So in the campaign, he sort of made a point about the arms lobby. He recently gave an interview on Fox News where he said individuals in the Pentagon who negotiate contracts with arms companies should not be allowed to work for an arms company for the rest of their life when they leave the Pentagon. And it's a common practice now for people to do that kind of thing. And he's done tweets criticizing Boeing for what he sees as excessive costs for Air Force One, and Lockheed Martin overruns on the F-35. He spoke highly of a report in the Washington Post about the Pentagon trying to cover up $125 billion worth of waste. So there's that element. That's sort of one Donald Trump. But then during the campaign, he pretty much endorsed a plan by the Heritage Foundation, which is very conservative, very hawkish, gets contractor money to help, you know, support itself. And so they want a 350-ship Navy, which is, the Navy is now about 270 ships or so. They want to add tens of thousands of Army troops and Marines. They want a bigger Air Force. They want to accelerate a buildup of the nuclear weapons arsenal. And they want to build a huge missile defense system, far larger than anything that's been contemplated in recent years. So that plan would cost almost an extra $1 trillion over 10 years from what the Pentagon's current trajectory is. So, you know, one fear I have is that Trump will use rhetoric about military waste to kind of distract attention from the fact that he is throwing massive amounts of money at the Pentagon. You know, that remains to be seen. But, of course, you know, throughout his administration, he has brought in corporate executives. He's brought in, you know, generals. He's pick for Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, is a general, but he also served on the board of General Dynamics, a major weapons contractor, received $1 million in compensation in his 3 years with the company. So those kinds of things are kind of the definition of what Eisenhower had in mind when he talked about the military-industrial complex. So it's kind of a question of which Trump will it be, and, you know, what will influence him, to, you know, which path he'll
go down. So it's the people which he has selected. I mean, he may flip-flop and keep you in suspense until the last minute, as he wants to do. But the people he has selected, do they give you any indication what direction he might go?
Well, I'm quite concerned. You know, his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, is virulently anti-Islam. You know, he's made statements about Islam not being a real religion, that it's really a political movement. He said that Sharia law is spreading throughout the United States. He's targeted Iran and said that they're the linchpin of a global anti-United States alliance that stretches from Venezuela to China to Russia. And I think he's spoiling for some sort of military action against Iran. The Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, is not as extreme as Flynn, but he is. When he was asked about the three biggest threats in the United States, he said Iran, Iran, and Iran. And he left the Obama administration because he had disagreements about whether to take certain kinds of military action against Iran in the midst of when President Obama was trying to help negotiate the nuclear weapons deal with Tehran. So so that's quite concerning. You've got these hawks who seem like they're going to demonize Iran. And if, you know, if Trump continues to sort of, you know, buddy up with Vladimir Putin and you know, refrain from criticizing Russia, it's quite possible that Iran will become the new demon that will be pointed to as a reason to build up the U.S. military.
That will be once they have some time demonizing China.
Yes. Yes, you know, they've got sort of multiple arguments that they will bring to bear as to why they need more money, why they need forces stretched all over the world, why they need a bigger nuclear arsenal. And it's, you know, it's fear-driven. You know, if you took a kind of a cold, hard look at the U.S. military deployments and weapon systems, and, you know, I think I certainly believe that it's far in excess of what's needed for defense. You know, it's really a global interventionary system, which I think has caused more harm, certainly in the targeted countries, but also to the United States, than any good it possibly could have done. Now, Trump has said, he said in the campaign that he opposed the Iraq War, which was not entirely clear when he got on board with that. He seemed to have rewritten history a bit. But nonetheless, he criticized that war. He said he was against wars of regime change. He said they got us into a lot of problems we have now. So he's got that anti-interventionist rhetoric. But on the other hand, he's talked about using nuclear weapons against ISIS, which, of course, would be a global calamity of almost unparalleled proportions. So, he's kind of all over the map. And there was actually an article in the Washington Post within the last couple of days saying that Trump subscribed to the madman theory of foreign policy. And this goes back to Richard Nixon. Nixon told his advisors during the Vietnam War that he wanted his Vietnamese adversaries to think that he was a madman, that they couldn't predict what he was going to do, that if they didn't do what he wanted, he might go so far as to use nuclear weapons. And so this article suggested that if Trump, in fact, has a strategy, which I think, might be debatable, it's this notion of keeping people off balance, people not knowing what he might do, and therefore somehow being cowed into doing what he wants them to do. But, of course, in the world that we live in, with multiple centers of power, with different countries have different and conflicting interests, the idea that one country can just lay down the law and another country is going to fall into line, I think, is a outdated concept. And I think it's quite dangerous, given how unpredictable the world is at the moment.
Now, tell me this. When he made a statement of, oh, we shouldn't make missiles we don't need, and we need not waste money and things like that, do you think you received any calls that, being an expert in this field, people want to talk to you in the mainstream media? Did mainstream media actually dwell on that aspect of his statement?
The biggest focus has been very recent, because the Washington Post did a piece demonstrating that the Pentagon commissioned a study from a thing called the Defense Business Board to look at waste in the Pentagon. And they found that the Pentagon has a huge bureaucracy, they hire too many contractors, that they could probably save $125 billion over 5 years just by cleaning up their bureaucracy. And the Pentagon didn't want this to be discussed because they were in the middle of asking for more money. And they didn't want Congress to think, well, if there's all this waste, why don't they take care of that before we give them more money? So they tried to suppress the report. And the Washington Post got a hold of the report and also some of the internal deliberations about trying to cover up the report. So that particular report did stimulate quite a bit of discussion in the mainstream media, huge social media presence. Those of us who work on these issues were contacted by a number of news outlets to discuss it. And so I think the question is, as often is the case with these things, is will that concern be sustained? I mean, will this be kind of a one-time story and we'll go back to business as usual, or will it stimulate further critique, discussion, investigation of how the Pentagon operates?
You mentioned those of us who work on this issue. How many are you who work on this issue, and who funds something like that to counter a military-industrial complex, who seems to be something nobody can handle?
Well, I'm part of a network of organizations, a lot of them based in D.C., some of them with members around the country. Probably a dozen organizations at most, with different levels of involvement at different times. And, within that universe, there's a relatively small number of us who do research. Some people do education on Capitol Hill. Some people try to get their members to speak to Congress and promote certain reforms. Funding generally comes from a relatively small swath of progressive foundations and individuals, and it's an uphill battle. The peace movement has a handful of lobbyists who go up to Capitol Hill to talk about issues like reducing nuclear weapons or cutting the Pentagon budget. The arms industry in a given year could have anywhere between 800 and 1,000 lobbyists.
Wow.
So, it's not a fair fight, in terms of just personnel and money, but we can win some victories, you know, where we can make the argument to the public clearly, and given that some of the things that the Pentagon and the contractors want to do are particularly outrageous.
So those who go on lobbying on this thing are this small group of 10 or so organizations. how many of those are those who grew up in that period of idealism in which you grew up and you adopted that as your continued interest of research and writing? And how many of them are from the younger crowd?
Well, there's a number of the leaders came out of the anti-Vietnam War movement, some of the movements of the 70s. But there's a new generation of activists, you know, in their 20s and 30s, who are taking up these issues as well. So there's kind of there's some fresh energy. But, of course, there's a lot of issues to be addressed in our country now, even before this recent election. And so I think among younger Americans, they have a lot of choices of where to turn in terms of urgent issues that they might work on. There's police violence. There's crackdowns on immigrants. You know, there's various foreign policy issues that they're concerned about. And so, you know, there's climate change. So I think, you know, the issues of Pentagon spending and nuclear weapons are not at the top of the list of the new generation of activists. They're aware of it. There are people who have put energy into it. But it's not like the anti-war movement or even the anti-apartheid movement where you really had a rallying of, you know, many, many progressive forces behind one or two issues. You know, there's more issues and more different groups working on different aspects of, you know, the political problems. And so I think particularly in the era of Trump, it'll be important to try to figure out how to knit these movements together, you know, to work in common, particularly on some of the most urgent issues, which are going to come at us very quickly. And that's a challenging thing to do, but I think it needs to be done.
Many of these issues, William, I see they become a realm of a partisan effort. For example, climate change. So you got Al Gore as its prophet, and everybody of similar types are high on it. And suddenly, you know, the Republicans are the people on the right side, by and large. So they see it as a partisan issue, not as something which concerns everyone. Do you see some people, even not a whole lot, who are from the right or from the religious right, who are concerned about, if not about arms control, but wastage, just like you mentioned McCain, Senator McCain raising questions. So are there some think tanks, some people who write about the wastage being efficient from the efficiency perspective, if not ideologically peace perspective?
Yes. In fact, some of them work with our network on certain issues, like, you know, the Pentagon, in 1990, Congress required every federal agency to get its books in order so it could pass an audit. And now, 27 years later, the Pentagon has never passed an audit. So they often don't know things like how many contractors they employ, how many spare parts they have, just basic knowledge that you would need to avoid waste, fraud, and abuse. So there was a kind of a right-left coalition to push the issue of auditing the Pentagon. And in fact, there was the bill in the Senate, which had about 8 co-sponsors, ranged from Ted Cruz on the right to Bernie Sanders on the left in terms of co-sponsors. So there's issues like that. There's taxpayer responsibility groups who go after cost overruns and weapon systems. There's many groups on the right, libertarian and others, who are in favor of keeping caps on the Pentagon budget. They've sort of acknowledged that if you're going to reduce the size of government, Pentagon is a huge part of the government. You can't ignore it if you're trying to reduce government spending. So there are some overlaps, and also in the libertarian sphere, there are quite a few anti-interventionists, and actually some of the libertarian groups actually have called for larger cuts in Pentagon spending than even some of the liberal groups. So there's some interesting overlaps or synergies on certain aspects of the issue, but you know, obviously there are others where there's no common ground.
You're listening to Radio Islam at WCAV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. This is your host, Malik Mujahid, and I'm talking with William Hartung, who is an expert on military-industrial complex, understanding it, and what makes people who pick up the causes, which are so difficult to handle. We'll be right back after these messages.
Radio Islam now presents Marked in Time with historian Faraz Al-Khatib.
Assalamu alaikum and peace be upon you. Last week we discussed the experience of Jews after the fall of Muslim Spain in 1492. But what happened to its Muslim community? For over 700 years, from the 8th to the 15th century, Muslims ruled in Spain. At its peak, Muslim civilization in Spain boasted of hundreds of libraries and schools, stable government, and a population of over 5 million Muslims, which included Arabs, Berbers, and Hispanics. But beginning in the 11th century, northern Christian kingdoms slowly conquered Muslim Spain. By 1492, the final Muslim state, Granada, fell and Islamic political power in the peninsula ended. But a huge number of Muslim civilians still lived in Spain, and the Catholic monarchs had to figure out what to do with them. At first, they hoped Muslims would voluntarily convert to Christianity. After 8 years of minimal conversions, the Spanish government decided to get tougher. In 1502, Islam was officially outlawed and Muslims had to fake conversion to Christianity to avoid being put to death. For the next 100 years, hundreds of thousands of Spanish Muslims practiced Islam in secret. They were known as Moriscos. Since any public display of Islam could lead to execution, the Moriscos had to practice Islam behind closed doors. They acted as Christians in public, went to church, ate pork, had Christian names, but would go home and worship as Muslims. The Spanish government knew that most Moriscos were not sincere Christians, and after 100 years of hoping that Islam would be stamped out, they eventually chose to expel all Moriscos in 1609. They were forced to immigrate to North Africa, but many died along the way. Their property was confiscated and their young children taken to be raised as Christians. Despite this horrific end, the 100 years of Islamic practice in secret is one of the prouder moments in Islamic history. It is the story of perseverance and faith in the face of oppression. That's something Muslims and non-Muslims can learn from. I'm historian Faraz Al-Khatib with Marked in Time for Radio Islam. See you next week. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Welcome back to Radio Islam. You're listening to WCAV 1450 AM in Chicago and www.radioislam.com throughout the world. This is your host, Malik Mujahid, and I'm talking with William Hartung about the military-industrial complex. You mentioned, William, in a very nice words that, you know, young people have so many causes and they're busy, they're coming up, and this thing is not their priority at this moment. Nice way of putting that not many of them are paying attention to the cause which you have adopted, right?
Yes. I mean, we're trying to change that reality, but I think that's an accurate description of where things stand.
So, would you say about 25% of the people who go to lobby on this issue and all that, maybe from in their 20s, 30s?
It's possible, yes. I mean, you know, 25% of a relatively small group of people that work on this kind of thing full-time.
Okay. Now, do you think that so you got involved in this fairly early in anti-apartheid movement and watching what weapons are going to South Africa and all that. What's the difference between the generation at that time and a generation today when it comes to peace movement?
Well, I think, you know, I came along in a kind of a funny time for activism in the United States because the anti-Vietnam War movement had subsided, the war ended in 1975, and I was going to college in the late 70s, early 80s. So I think, you know, there was kind of a splintering at that time of people into different movements and discussions about was there one galvanizing issue. And I think, but for a lot of us, I think the anti-apartheid issue served that purpose because there was a large student movement active. There were people in the churches active. There were local officials active. So it became, you know, quite a large combination of people and institutions pressing to the point where they even got the Reagan administration to sign off on U.S. sanctions on the apartheid regime. So, you know, I think perhaps there were a couple issues that kind of, you know, got more attention than others and pulled together kind of, you know, large numbers of people. You know, I would say maybe the biggest issue now for a lot of young people, it might be climate change in terms of, you know, focus and, of course, fighting police violence. So, you know, it's definitely different times, but I think there was also a, you know, there were people who had come out of the anti-war movement who were still active in the 70s who were, you know, educators, mentors, you know, helped politicize people who were younger than them.
So anti-war movement, when Iraq war was being invaded and all that, was that anti-war movement, have people left over with some energy from the anti-war movement you were part of? Because that didn't leave any residual, did it?
No, it was interesting. The, you know, the biggest demonstrations I attended, some of them quite large, were before the war started. Once the war started, it was much harder to mobilize large numbers of people. Eventually, there was an impact through the electoral system. Some of the anti-war candidates were elected. President Obama ran on an anti-Iraq war platform, although he made it clear that he would possibly step up the war in Afghanistan. So he wasn't, in fact, a peace candidate. But nonetheless, he used the Iraq war issue on his way to the presidency, and some of that, I think, was a result of the organizing against the war that had been done you know, by citizens' organizations. But it certainly wasn't the kind of sustained, growing mass movement that was present in the movement against the Vietnam War. It was much more episodic, and it wasn't possible to sustain high levels of activity. You know, I think part of that may have been related to the aftershock of 9/11, you know, the September 11th attacks, because I think people were more timid about coming out against the wars. I think there was more backlash against activists and spokespersons who were, you know, pushing for peaceful and diplomatic solutions to the problems that United States faces in the world. So I think that might have been an element of it. And I think also, you know, I think some people just didn't feel like we could win. You know, I think some people felt like, well, you know, they could put energy into this, but the odds politically were stacked against them. But as I said, eventually that activism, I think, did shift the political system, at least against the occupation of Iraq.
How much is collaboration between people who are, you know, your topic on arms control and arms reduction and people who work on nuclear disarmament or, you know, different angles of it, Is there a broader network of people like that?
Yes. There's some overlap. There's some organizations that work primarily on nuclear weapons issues, and there's some organizations that are multi-issue, so they work on Pentagon spending, anti-war work, and reducing nuclear weapons. So there's kind of shifting networks and coalitions depending on the issue. And some of the anti-nuclear weapons groups have acknowledged that as long as the Pentagon is able to absorb huge quantities of our tax dollars, it's going to be very hard to roll back the nuclear weapons buildup that the Pentagon is contemplating over the next few decades. So there's definitely points of contact and overlap, but there are some groups that are much more narrowly focused on the nuclear issue, and budgetary issue is secondary or only involved in to the extent to which it can be used as a way to reduce funding for nuclear weapons.
Is there any intersection between the the absent, I would say almost absent anti-war movement? I mean, the war is going around all over, but there seems to be no anti-war movement. And do you think the causes like yours can benefit from a movement, not just the research and writing?
Well, I think without a movement, it'll be very difficult to make progress. There's one theory of change, which is that you work at the elite level and you make better arguments than the other side, and eventually your point of view will triumph. But I think that doesn't really take into account the actual political dynamics, particularly when you're dealing with a large arms lobby and arms establishment. So there have to be political activists, putting pressure on Congress, putting pressure on the media, elevating the issue, showing that there's a political cost to be suffered for lining up behind the military-industrial complex's agenda. And so there are organizations that do that, groups like the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Women's Action for New Directions. There's a group called Peace Action, which grew out of the nuclear freeze movement. But again, the numbers are not huge, but there's some very effective activists who have focused particularly on key members of Congress on certain issues. But certainly we would benefit from a larger movement and also more links among related movements.
You definitely said there is not much hope on these causes if there is no movement. And what I see is, whether I'm with labor, I see the more organization, sort of bureaucracy also, but not much of a movement. Are causes becoming more professionalized, and that professionalism is causing movement to disappear? Or it's the educational system, or what is it? I mean, there are so many challenges out there. And of course, with the exception of the mobilization on climate change issue or Black Lives Matter issue, where you can see some resemblance of movement, or the Standing Rock movement, which achieved quite a bit of attention. Why America at this time does not have a whole lot of attention on creating a movement on issues?
I think there's a few factors. I think, one problem is we've become sort of an entertainment society where people, rather than addressing serious problems, would rather not think about them, would rather focus on their own lives, their families, their friends. And of course, I mean, Donald Trump in many ways is an entertainment figure, more so than a political leader, in my opinion. So I think there's that. I think there's a strong feeling among many people that there's corruption in the political system, and that it's not possible to really achieve change, and therefore they don't participate in a lot of these movements. But I think that will change. I think the climate change movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, I think will eventually spark movement on other issues, by example, and also just because there's some overlaps among issues. I think we might be at a point where we'll see some movement building behind a number of these issues. But, of course, we're working under quite difficult circumstances given the new administration and the new Congress. So it's going to have to be, a significant citizen mobilization, I think, to not only defend gains that have been achieved over the years, but if we're going to try to move forward on some of these issues.
Well, thank you so much. You have been, William, heart and kind enough to spare a good amount of time with us and dwell on issues which are very important for our time and our society. And I hope Trump will get some of the credit for turning some of these causes into a movement.
Yes, and he does like getting credit.
So. He liked getting credit. So one of the group I was talking with, and we're talking about registry of Muslims and mobilizing against that and resisting. You see, this guy takes energy by resistance. Maybe somebody needs to just go and charm him and say, anything which you want. And he will be happy and move away from that idea. So they say the Japanese model, Japanese Prime Minister came and met with him, and things seems to be very nice. And he met with Obama. He said, Obama is a nice guy.
Yeah, I think that's he has such a large ego that I think stroking his ego can kind of calm him down for a while. But on the other hand, he's very erratic, so you don't know if that will stick.
So maybe we need to discover a pill which can sustain an ego once it is satisfied to a certain level.
Well, that would be a good goal.
Well, thank you so much, William Hartung. We truly appreciate you being with us and giving us your time. Look forward to talking to you some other time also.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. William Hartung is Director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. And you have been listening to Radio Islam. But before you go, you should know that our great producer, Olivia Richardson, is looking for hiring interns. She's looking for a whole lot of things, but don't ask me about it. But hiring interns. So you can email her at producer@radioislam.com. You have been listening to Radio Islam, a call-in talk show from 6 to 7 p.m., 7 days a week, on WCAV 1450 AM. To find out more about tonight's guest and their work, hop on to soundcloud.com/Radio Islam USA, where you can also stream, download, and comment on our shows. You can also catch us on iTunes and Google Play and stream straight from your phone. Don't forget to rate and review our podcast. Follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook at Radio Islam USA. Our producer today, as I mentioned, is Olivia Richardson, as Wahaj Khan is vacationing in warm California, I guess.
Yeah, California.
California. Our engineer this evening is Gus Royce. Thank you, Gus. Radio Islam is a Sound Vision Foundation production. The views expressed are the views of the host and the guest, not of the Sound Vision Foundation. I'm your host, Malik Mujahid, and join us tomorrow evening for another great show right here at WCV 1450 AM as well as www.radioislam.com. Peace. Salam. ¶¶